This is the afternoon magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Almost everyone has had a major falling out with someone close. Today on the afternoon magazine, our topic is reconciliation, and our guest is Laura Davis. She's the author of I Thought We'd Never Speak Again, The Road from Estrangement to Reconciliation. We'll talk with her about reconciliation and forgiveness and how to go about taking the first step toward reconnection. Laura Davis is an expert on healing. Her books are bestsellers around the world. In addition to I Thought We'd Never Speak Again, Davis's books include The Courage to Heal, Allies in Healing, Becoming the Parent You Want to Be, a source book for strategies for the first 5 years. That's a source book of strategies for the first 5 years. Listeners, join the discussion. I look forward to your questions and comments this afternoon. Maybe you have a story of reconciliation you'd like to share with us. We'd love to hear from you. Join us with a telephone call. In Champaign-Urbana, our number, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Laura Davis, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sure. How did you come to this work you do in the areas of healing and reconciliation?
The topic of reconciliation is a very personal one for me. I had a very difficult 7-year estrangement from my mother, and both of us thought we would never speak again. And it was over an issue that we both felt was irreconcilable, that there was no resolution. And yet we have found our way back to each other and have been working on a reconciliation for about 8 years now, and today are very close. And because of that very profound personal experience of healing a situation that seemed impossible, I became very interested in how other people had done it in their lives. Mm. So I set out to interview people in all kinds of circumstances to find out what makes peacemaking possible.
Yeah, and that's a picture of you and your mom on your webpage?
Yeah, that's right.
And listeners, if you're interested, you can find Laura on the website, www.lauradavis.net. The book went to press last September, not long after the attacks of September 11th. Did those attacks and their aftermath emphasize for you the importance of relationships and the importance of tending and taking care of those relationships?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that was not just my experience. I think that was the experience of millions of people all over the world, because when something like September 11th happens, a major wake-up tragedy, or it could be something in our own life. It could be a wonderful thing, like the birth of a child. It could be the death of someone close to us, a brush with mortality. Any of these kind of life experiences that sort of wake us up out of our stupor, of our routine, it makes us realize that what really matters is connection and people and relationships. I have a little poster in my office. It's a picture of a man holding his little son on skis, and underneath the caption says, "Nobody ever died wishing they spent more time at work." And I think there are these times in our lives when we wake up to the fact that people are precious and that we can't afford to throw them away. So I've seen a lot of people reaching out across estrangements in the months since September 11th. I think there's a real motivation to let go of petty grievances, or to let go of old gripes, to figure out how to live life in the present and to make all the connections that we can.
Yeah. One of the things that jumped out at me immediately from the outset of the book was the sorrow that estrangement carries with it. In the stories people shared with you, was there always an ache? I'm thinking of someone who said to you that when he decided to let go of the past hurts his brother, I believe it was, had inflicted, that it wasn't, he said, it wasn't a head thing, it was a whole body thing.
I think in most cases, estrangement is very painful. It's, sometimes when an estrangement is new, it can be an agony. It can be an excruciating grief, anger, rage, loneliness, feelings of shame. Why did this happen to me? Very intense feelings. As time goes on, we sort of compartmentalize the loss of the relationship, and it becomes more like a dull ache. In some instances, I've talked to people who said, one woman I'm thinking of, she was estranged from her brother for 30 years. And she said she grew up in a family where no one was very connected to begin with. She said a weekend in her house was everyone in their own room with a closed door. So she had grown up in a family where people weren't bonded to each other. There wasn't much relationship. So when her brother just stopped speaking to her, and she never knew the reason, it just seemed normal to her. And so for her, she was an example of someone who said it really wasn't a big deal to her either way. She had just moved on in her life. But it just felt like, you know, one screwed up, as she put it, she said, one screwed up piece of my life just got fit back into place when she reached out to her brother. Mm. So for some people, it's a bigger loss and a bigger grief than for others. But I think for most people, it just feels like something in the world is not right. You know, estrangements make our world smaller, and they make us less than we want to be.
Yeah, closing off possibilities.
Closing off to our history, too.
Mm.
You know, sometimes if it's a sibling or a family member or an old friend, we lose that relationship and we lose the only person who was a witness to what our life was like in the past. And that is a really big loss. Sometimes you don't even realize it till you get that person back and they could make one look or one gesture or one reference. And, you know, the two of you just crack up because you have this common frame of reference that no one else shares.
Yeah.
And that's an incredible thing to get back when you reconcile.
There's a story in the book about a woman who was estranged from her father for some number of years, and she came to understand that that what she was doing in part, you know, in terms of being upset and hurt about their estrangement, was that she'd lost so much time. It was almost as if she was grieving for what had been lost, possibilities and history and one another's company and what had been lost over that period of time.
Yeah, I think there is grief, but I also, you know, what I recommend to people is that all we have is right now. You know, if you take a breath at this very moment, you know, that is it. That is what life is about. It's right now. And I'm thinking of a woman I talked to who was a very severe alcoholic when her children were young. And as a result, she was a very negligent mother. And she got sober when her daughters were in their early 20s. And when she started to realize what she had done to them, you know, the price that they were paying because of her alcoholism, she felt incredible remorse. And she felt so guilty. And she was always apologizing to them and saying how sorry she was. But in a way, what she was doing is keeping the focus on her and on the past. And she had a sponsor in AA who said to her, you know, you're really making yourself the victim here. You know, poor me, look what I did. She said, what you really need to do is focus on how you could be a good mother today. What can you do to support your daughters right now? And she realized the wisdom of that, and when she got her daughters into focus, suddenly they stopped being these needy children that she had abandoned, and they became these young women who really could use the support of a wiser, older woman. And so she stepped in, and she was able to be a good parent in the present, and that really transformed their relationship. So, you know, in some ways you can't, like, brush the past under the rug. You have to acknowledge that it happened, but you also have to see what is possible right now in this relationship with this person. Today, what can I do today?
Mm. Is there something you can say in general about what leads to the extreme of estrangement?
There's not one thing. There's money is an issue. A lot of times estrangements happen over a will, over possessions that have been left behind, around the energy that happens around someone's death, a lot of times things that have been sort of kept under wraps. I did a talk last night, and one woman said that she is completely estranged from her brother, and in her instance she says she wants to be. She doesn't want to reconcile with him because she felt like he was an incredibly negative, hostile influence in her life that she spent years getting away from. And she said she kept up a relationship with him until both her parents died because it was so important to them. And as soon as her father died, she just never spoke to her brother again. So, you know, sometimes around a death, that changes the energy, and sometimes truer feelings come to the surface. Sometimes it's a philosophical difference. You know, a parent can't accept a gay child. Sometimes adult siblings argue about what to do with an aging parent. Sometimes kids are alienated from one of their parents in the course of a divorce. You know, and sometimes it's just immaturity. You know, one person not being able to apologize or acknowledge a mistake. And those kind of estrangements that are, you know, more based on pride and ego, they're more easily resolved. One person basically just has to step up to the plate and say, you know, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that, or, you know, let's do such and such right now. But the estrangements that are based on a real serious breach of trust, it's a much longer process to try to rebuild those relationships.
Yeah. Well, what do you do if you want to reconcile, but the other person is not interested?
Well, that's always the risk we take. I had an experience like that in my own life. I had some very dear friends. Our children were best friends with each other. We, you know, went on vacations together. We sent our kids to the same school. We picked up each other's children. We, you know, had dinner together once or twice a week. It was like an extended family. And I did something that they found, you know, appalling, terrible. To me, it was a really small thing. It really showed, you know, a difference in values or a difference in ethics of how to operate in the world. Anyway, I did something that was insensitive to them, and they were outraged. And I remember my first reaction was to be defensive, like, you know, why are you making a mountain out of a molehill? And, of course, that made things much worse. And eventually they stopped speaking to me, and several months went by, and I realized that this was not going to blow over and that I was going to have to do something. And so I sat down, I wrote a letter of apology, and I really reflected on what I had done. I put myself in their shoes and tried to see the whole situation from their point of view. And I wrote a very sincere letter of apology, basically begging, can we get together and work this out? And I listed all the reasons, you know, our friendship was valuable and our family should stay connected. And I remember I went out to the mailbox and I had that fear that you're talking about. I'm going to make myself vulnerable to these people who really have the power to hurt me. And I stood there for half an hour just agonizing over whether or not to mail that letter. Finally, I thought to myself, you know, I really have nothing to lose. I've already lost the friendship. And so I mailed my letter, and they never responded.
Mm.
And in some ways, for me, that was the most painful response. If they had called up and wanted to get together and yell at me and tell me I was a terrible person, or, you know, I was rude or I was arrogant or anything, would have been better than their silence. Because for me, I felt dismissed as a person, that I wasn't even worthy of a response. So it was excruciating. But now, when I look back at it, I think, you know, I had the courage to attempt reconciliation. And I had the strength to apologize to people I loved. And I stepped up to the plate. And the fact that they couldn't meet me there, it really didn't lessen the significance of what I had done.
Mm.
And once I realized that the relationship truly was over, then I could take steps to find a place of resolution inside myself, which I wouldn't have done if I hadn't, you know, taken the risk to find out where they stood.
Mm. When is it appropriate to continue making the first step, taking the first step, making an overture?
Well, sometimes it takes a long time. I'm thinking of a father I interviewed. He had a young adult daughter who was maybe 30 years old, and his wife died of cancer, and very quickly he remarried. And the daughter was outraged that he had married so quickly, and she felt like it was, you know, blasphemy to her mother, and she just had it in for this new mother-in-law or stepmother, and, you know, she couldn't get along, and they became very estranged, and really it was a rift between the daughter and the stepmother. And the father, after several years of realizing that, you know, it was creating problems in his new marriage, he was feeling bitter about that, and he was also alienated from his daughter, he decided to be a go-between. And what's interesting in his case is that he was someone who approached his daughter. At first he did so much more of the giving and the initiating. He would travel 2 or 3 hours to where she lived and sit and basically listen to her, all her little gripes and complaints and all the things that were bothering her. And, of course, he had things bothering him too, but he went just to listen and to hear her out. And he did this for a whole year. Once a month he would go see her. And at the end of a year of really listening and giving her attention and validating her feelings, the daughter began to shift. And she began to be willing to come to visit at their house. And she came, and he was really able to negotiate. It's more like a detente than a true reconciliation. You know, I mean, they are able to have a relationship now. I don't think those two women are ever going to be close, but they could all be at family gatherings together. They can, you know, make small talk together. They can have some semblance of a cordial relationship. And that came from his patience of being willing to initiate and initiate and initiate. And basically, he said, you know, I realized I didn't want to sweat the small stuff, that I had a bigger objective in mind. And so he sacrificed some of his own needs in the short term for a long-term goal that he succeeded at. So that's one example. You know, if you feel like you're just knocking your head against the wall and nothing is coming back to you, then you have to reevaluate. And there is a point where it's time to let go of a relationship. And sometimes that's the healthiest thing we could do. No one can really tell you when you reach that point. But reconciliation is not about being a doormat. It's not about going back into a situation where you're treated badly consistently. You know, that's more capitulation. That's not reconciliation. Reconciliation, you feel strong and you feel powerful and you feel like you know who you are in that situation. Mm-hmm. And you leave it feeling good.
What's the difference between reconciling and apologizing?
Well, apologies can be part of reconciliation.
Right.
And often they're an important part because in most instances when there's an estrangement, both people have played a role in creating the rift or keeping the rift going. You know, there are exceptions. Child abuse is an example. The child does not bear any responsibility for what happened. But in most kind of garden variety estrangements, both people have things to be accountable for. And if either or both can step up and say, you know, I shouldn't have done this, it was wrong, that really can make a reconciliation just leap to a whole different level. I know when someone sincerely apologizes to me, what comes up automatically is forgiveness for them because they've been accountable. I think the important thing to say about apologies is that they have to be backed up with action. If someone says, you know, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that, and then they go do the same thing all over again, well, the words are meaningless. So I look for, in other people and in myself, am I going to back up this apology with a change in the way I operate in the world, which is, of course, much harder than just saying you're sorry. So to answer your bigger question, apologies can be part of reconciliation, but reconciling is a lot more than just saying you're sorry.
Mm.
It doesn't end there.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that's the beginning.
Well, early in the book, you talk about reconciliation being a continuum.
Yeah, I talk about four kinds of reconciliation, and I believe that anyone, no matter what their circumstance, can achieve reconciliation in one of these four ways. The first way is sort of the storybook ending, you know, what we see in the movies or on TV. Both people change, both people grow, and there's a deep healing in the relationship. When that happens, it's fabulous. It's a phenomenal experience. I've had that with my best friend of 25 years. We had a rift early in our relationship, and today we're so changed from who we were back then, and we're much closer than we ever were. So that's great when that can happen, when the problem that you have or the rift actually deepens your relationship because you've gone through this trial and come out on the other side. That's the first kind. It's the kind we all want. It's also the least common outcome. The second kind is where one person changes their expectations of the relationship. And this is the kind of, and sometimes the other person doesn't even change at all, but it changes our perception and the way we act when we're with the other person. This is the kind of situation where you're dealing with an obnoxious relative. Let's say you're going to a Father's Day party, and your brother-in-law, who you can't stand, is going to be there because he's a sarcastic, cynical, mean-spirited person.
Mm.
And a lot of times we go into those situations and we get injured every single time that person says something. If you can look at the situation realistically, look at who the person is, maybe where they came from and why they're that way, we can be more realistic about what to expect. Sometimes it's, if we could look at the situation almost like a movie director, and this person is a character in this movie, you know, who has very predictable lines, we can get into that situation and not feel wounded every single time. We could develop more of a sense of humor about it, and sometimes when we need to, we could walk away from the person. I have someone in my life right now who's related to me by my daughter-in-law, someone in her family. So, you know, your children get married, you get all these other people in your life. And this woman, for me, is a very difficult person. And yet I have really made an effort every time I see her, and she's here a lot because my daughter-in-law and my grandson live with me. And we want her to be here. We want her support.
Mm-hmm.
I really make an effort to find some positive way that I could interact with her. You know, and I have found there are certain topics, certain things we could talk about that are actually quite pleasant. And so for me, it's a challenge. I take it on as a challenge. She's not someone I think I'll ever be very close to,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know if I'll ever trust her because I know things that she's done in the past that, you know, I really felt hurt by. But I have found a way to find some way to create a cordial relationship that feels positive to me, and I feel like that's a great accomplishment. So that's another type of reconciliation where you manage to expect different things from people, and it changes your experience. Another little story in that regard, which was where the other person did change. There was a woman who had a brother who, the way she described him, she said he's always whining about the past and talking about his terrible childhood. And she just felt like, oh, just grow up and get a life. And finally one day she said she wasn't sure why, but she really listened to what he had to say. And she was deeply moved by the suffering he had experienced. And she said, my God, I am so sorry that happened to you. And she said that one comment changed their whole relationship, and he never talked about his childhood again. So, you know, it's an example where one person made a shift, and it changed the trajectory of the whole relationship.
Hmm.
The third kind of reconciliation is what my mother and I did. We agreed to disagree. We had an issue between us that we could not resolve, and we agreed to respectfully disagree about it. I stopped trying to get her to change, And she stopped trying to get me to change. And then we looked, okay, what else is there in our relationship aside from this disagreement that we could base a new relationship on? And we built up from there. So that's the third kind. And the fourth is when a relationship is impossible with the other person because they're too hostile, because they've died, because they're drunk. For whatever reason, it's not possible to have it with them. There is a path to reconciliation on the inside where we find a sense of resolution and peace for the loss of that relationship. So those are the four kinds.
That fourth kind, the impossible reconciliation, in the case where someone has died, and I imagine that this is fairly common, that you never got around to it, you couldn't at the time. How difficult is it to make that kind of internal reconciliation with someone who, let's say, has died, who's no longer there?
Well, I think reconciliation is never easy, any of these types. You know, it takes work and it takes a real inner commitment. But I think sometimes for people it's easier when someone has died because let's say you're talking about someone who has been sort of a larger-than-life figure to you, someone who has hurt you, someone you had sort of set up as a monster, you know, someone who you didn't feel safe with. And, you know, usually it's pretty extreme if someone goes all the way to death and you haven't spoken to them. So, you know, usually it is something pretty serious. When that happens, when the person dies, what happens is that we're safe suddenly. They can't hurt us anymore. They can't, you know, make that remark. They can't hit us. They can't say the one thing that's just going to cut us to the quick because we're not threatened by them anymore. And what happens a lot of times when someone dies is that we feel grief. We feel anger at what we lost. We feel grief about what we didn't have. And sometimes when the person is dead, we also can feel the love that we initially felt for them because it's safe to let those more tender feelings out. And so, you know, I think when in the grieving process, it's a wonderful time to come to peace with someone and to do that letting go. And doing it on your own is definitely possible. It doesn't require the other person because, you know, you don't always have the other person's cooperation. Mm-hmm. Or willingness to work on a relationship. When you do, of course, it's great. But when you don't, there's plenty that you could do on your own. One woman I'm thinking of was estranged from her father at the time that he died, and she now has a lot of regrets about that. But she has developed this whole relationship with him since they died. She said she has incredible dreams where he comes and visits her and gives her advice, and certain times she's up against challenges in her life, and she always thinks about her father because he was really good at operating in the world. And she said she feels more connected and closer to him now than she ever did when he was alive.
Two of the other types of reconciliation, change expectations and agree to disagree. In those situations, how do you determine how close you'd like to be with that other individual?
It's basically a trial and error process. You try something and you see what feels good. And sometimes maybe you expose too much of yourself or you take too big of a risk. Or you spend time with them and it doesn't feel good, so you back off a little bit. It's a very fluid thing. It's not like you draw a line in the sand and then that's where you are and that's your position. You feel your way through it, one day, one experience, one interaction at a time. You know, sometimes it might be that the kind of relationship you could have is that you could write letters to each other. But every time you try to visit and spend time together, you know, the whole thing kind of blows up in your face. And you might end up at a place where you think, okay, you know, we write good letters to each other, and that's the kind of relationship we're going to have. So there's not one answer to your question. It really depends on your individual circumstance, and each person is going to have to determine that, and it often changes over time.
Mm-hmm.
You could start off, you know, when my mother and I began our reconciliation process, I had a lot of rules. You know, she wasn't allowed to talk about this. She couldn't do this. I didn't want to hear her do this. And, you know, I only wanted to meet her at certain places and for a certain amount of time. And I had all these ground rules. And our relationship was extremely stiff. And we both were really afraid of making a mistake and, you know, being back in the doghouse, basically. And so there was a lot of fear and anxiety. And it was not relaxed or pleasant between us. There was a certain rigidity to our relationship. And now, 8 years later, we're incredibly relaxed with each other. And I don't feel worried about making a mistake or saying the wrong thing. And we've been able to talk about some very difficult subjects that we never could have talked about before. And that has taken time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes we take three steps forward and one step back. But we both had a strong commitment to rebuilding our relationship. And because of that, we had persistence. We just kept at it, even when there were setbacks. And that's really the kind of determination that reconciliation requires.
Yeah. Those rules that you had in that period of time when your relationship felt really stiff, you think that was necessary to go through that?
It was for me.
Yeah.
I didn't feel safe around my mother. I felt vulnerable to being really hurt by things she would say or do. And I think in my instance, feeling like I had some control in the relationship was really important at that time. I don't feel that now.
Yeah.
Now I feel much more generous. And I feel like I could... There are things that used to really irritate me about my mother. I mean, irritate is much too mild of a word. Things that really pissed me off and that, you know, I just was outraged by. And now I just look at it and I just think of it as one of her quirks. It's not like she's changed. But I look at her with more humor, with more compassion, with love, and I just see her as a flawed human being doing the best she can. And it's taken me many years to get to that point, you know, that she's not doing things consciously to hurt me, but this is just the best she could do. And, you know, I think for me becoming a parent was a very humbling thing because I realized how hard it is to be a good parent and how many times I fall short of my expectations and my intentions for myself, and that gave me a lot more compassion for her.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Laura Davis. Our topic is reconciliation. Laura Davis is the author of I Thought We'd Never Speak Again, The Road from Estrangement to Reconciliation. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. I look forward to hearing from you, your questions and comments. Maybe you have a story of reconciliation you'd like to share with us. Join us with a telephone call. In Champaign-Urbana, our number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Laura Davis, again, the author of I Thought We'd Never Speak Again, The Road from Estrangement to Reconciliation. And you'll find her on the web at www.lauradavis.net. Does time soften things, or can it make the situation more intractable?
Both. It definitely can do both.
There's no easy answers on this thing, is
no,
there?
No, there are times when time goes by and it's just like the issue that was between you becomes irrelevant. You know, if you had asked me in my 20s who I was, I would have described a whole particular set of characters. Certain issues would have been critical to me that are, you know, don't mean anything to me now, 20 years later. So sometimes time does change our perspective, and, you know, an issue that was really big for us may not matter anymore, and so we could easily let go of things. But other times people harden as they get older. You know, they have some little bit of a resentment, and they nurse it over a period of years, and, you know, it becomes ingrained and entrenched. And sometimes they don't even remember what the original incident is, but their hatred or their dislike of the other person grows. So it can go both ways. Some of it depends on just who we are as people. But time alone often is not enough. There needs to be something else mixed in for reconciliation to happen.
For some people, it can happen just in a moment, in the blink of an eye. For others, it takes years of work. In the book, there's a story of a woman by the name of Rachel and her sister Vivian. And they'd been estranged for some time. And then one day, Rachel's son comes to her and says, "Your sister Vivian is dying. We must go now." And he just said that, you know, flat out, "We're going tonight." Talk with us a little bit about the situation between Rachel and Vivian and how that's an example of how a reconciliation happened in the blink of an eye.
You know, it did. In a way, it did. I mean, there actually had been a softening in that relationship. I think those two women, their families had a couple of family reunions, maybe 7 years apart. It wasn't totally from complete estrangement to closeness. There were some steps on the way, but they still were not close when the sister Vivian got sick. And I think what Rachel said to me is, she said, you know, when she got to the hospital and she saw her sister, who was a young woman, you know, she was in her maybe 50 years old, in intensive care with this rare illness that just suddenly struck her, all she wanted was for her to live. And she said all that other stuff didn't matter anymore. And she said she took a risk. She became one of her caregivers when they had put her in a coma because they said if she even blinked an eyelash, she would have died. because all her body systems had shut down. And they didn't think she was going to live. And when she did live, and they brought her out of this coma, she really needed to learn to walk again and to do everything again. And Rachel, who was a school teacher, had the summer off, and she decided to go, this was in Salt Lake City, to go to Salt Lake City and be with her sister and help with her recovery. And she said it was a huge risk that she took because she really didn't know. Was she going to be welcomed with open arms? You know, was she going to be treated badly as she had been in the past? And she just decided none of that mattered and that she just wanted to help her sister. And in the course of helping to care for her, you know, their bond just really grew again. One interesting thing about their story, which I think says something interesting about estrangement, is that when I interviewed Rachel about what had happened between them and about how they became estranged, she told me this whole very detailed story that stemmed from her mother's death and her mother's funeral. And in great detail, she said this to me, and then this happened, and this, and this, and then, you know, they stopped speaking. And 6 months later, I got to interview Vivian, and I asked her the same question, what happened? And the thing that was really amazing, she told me a completely different story.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing in common was that it had happened at the same time frame around their mother's death. But the details of what had led to the estrangement were completely different stories. And when they talked to each other, neither one of them could even remember the incidents that the other sister remembered so vividly. And it really says something about how we remember our lives. And we tell these stories about our lives, and two people having the very same experience can have an extremely different take on it. And sometimes that's what enables reconciliation to occur. As time goes on, our perspective on our life and what happened begins to change.
Yeah, as you said earlier, the story you would tell about your life when you're 20 is different, you know, than the story that you would tell 15 years later.
Yeah.
Before someone makes a move to reconcile, is there always a recognition at some level of the cost of holding on to the reason for the estrangement, holding on to the hurt? Do you have to let that go before you can make a move to reconcile?
Yeah, I think there's both a cost. When I do workshops with people, I often ask them to look at the cost of the estrangement. What is this costing you? And that's pretty easy for people to say, you know, I don't trust people as much. I feel more disconnected. I'm not seeing my nieces and nephews. I miss being connected to that part of my history. You know, I miss doing such and such with my best friend. It's easy to talk about that, but there also are benefits. And that's much harder for people to get to. And the benefits could be things like not having to face the possibility of being rejected again, not having to acknowledge and admit mistakes we made, not having to face a part of ourselves. It could be that we've gotten a lot of mileage out of being a victim. And, you know, that something terrible happened to us, and people give us a lot of sympathy. And if we reconcile with the person, we may be giving that up, and we may be moving to a place where we're taking much more responsibility for our own life and not blaming it on something someone else did to us.
A listener's waiting to talk with us. Let's talk with this caller who's in Champaign, waiting on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is Jan Cheverson, and I love this program and this topic. I have four things I wanted to comment on, and I'll hang up and listen to the speaker. You talked about being a victim. I don't agree. I think being a victim is a terrible thing to be. But also the 911 issue. Our sons called us right after that happened, and we were so happy. And I just wondered how to sustain that that emotion. And the issue about time, the tincture of time, and also the whole topic of reconciliation fascinates me, especially where death is concerned. And I'll hang up and listen to the guest. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
I'm not exactly sure what the question was in that.
Well, I think she's asking you to comment on some observations or her experience. Apparently, she has children who called her, mm-hmm. and after on September 11th or shortly thereafter, and she was so pleased to hear from them. And it's like, you know, you are safe, and I love you, and thank God you're here, and that kind of thing. And she asked, you know, how do we make sure that we hang on to that kind of that feeling that how about perhaps, and here I'm, you know, kind of just extrapolating here a little bit, I guess, but how do we remember how important our loved ones are?
And yeah, I think that, you know, it's human nature, I think, to, it's almost like the clouds part, and we have this time of clarity because of situations like that where we see what comes into focus is what's really important. And then it's very easy for sort of our habitual patterns, whether it's being too busy or working too much or being careless in relationships or not taking the time to call parents or, you know, visit people, or those things, you know, come back. And I think it takes a commitment on each of our parts to say, you know, I don't want to live this way, that there is real value to making human relationships come first. And it's challenging for many people, but it just takes a daily commitment and a daily check-in. You know, how did I spend my time today? How did I allot what I did today? You know, in this week, have I, you know, kept in touch with my family? Have I, you know, reached out to my children? Have I, you know, what have I done with myself? And it takes a certain self-awareness and a desire to go in that direction. You can't make someone else do it. I think one of the things I've learned about reconciliation is that all we can change is ourselves. We do not have control over what other people think, how they act, how they respond, how they act in a relationship. We can't control those things. The only thing we can control is how we interact with them and what our choices are. And that can really make a big difference in our lives. But a lot of people I interviewed, when they talked about the freedom of not trying to change someone, that was an incredible liberation, to give up the idea that they could transform someone else.
The caller also mentioned time as a teacher, and I think this is something you write about in the book, as maturity as an element of in the process of reconciliation.
I know for me, I've had the experience of when I was younger, I really saw things in black and white. You know, someone was right or they were wrong. They were a good person or a bad person. And I see things much more in the gray now. I see people as complex, multifaceted human beings. And I see that someone who has done something terrible in their life or hurtful can also have good qualities. And there's a certain complexity that I am willing to embrace because I'm older and because I've had more life experience, and I've also become more disillusioned with myself. I'm more honest with myself about my own limitations. And that enables me to be much more generous with other people. And it certainly opens the door to reconciliation, because I can handle the fact that there's a paradox right in the center of every human being, and that I want to see all of who they are, not just the parts that feel good to me.
The story, I want to bring up a story of Elizabeth Menken and Susanna Cooper that you tell in the book. Here we have, let me back up. Let me start over. If I want to reconcile with someone and I know that I'm the person in the wrong and I've done a terrible thing, in this case, this involves a drunk driving situation. Susanna Cooper was drunk and behind the wheel and killed Elizabeth Menken's sister. And this is a story of forgiveness and reconciliation and mediation. I think Elizabeth Menken is a very wise woman, and she talked with you about the work of apology, that it's to make an apology, one has to do more than say, "I'm sorry."
Yeah, she said something like an apology is saying you're sorry without turning around and making an excuse with the other hand, or pointing the finger. You know, well, I'm sorry for this, but you did blah blah blah. I found Elizabeth's story amazing because people say to her, you know, that she's basically like a saint because she and her family went into mediation with this woman who killed her sister, the drunk driver Suzanne. Not only did they do that, but they ended up supporting her. They helped her go to community college. They wanted her to make something of her life, and they devoted themselves to helping this woman who was very troubled. It was her second drunk driving conviction. She had young children. They wanted her not to kill someone again. And what Elizabeth said to me, she said, you know, people think it was an altruistic move on our part. She said, but it wasn't. She said, I felt like if Suzanne ever killed someone else drunk, that I would have to kill her. And I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in jail. And she said that was a very real fear for me. And the way she talked about it, she said, you know, she owes us a life, and we're not going to let her throw hers away.
Mm.
And I think they really wanted the tragedy of this drunk driving death not to pass to the next generation. They wanted her children to have a chance in life. And they were very devoted to that. And they set the stipulations of what Suzanne would have to do. She did serve time in jail. This had nothing to do with what the courts did. But on top of that, they asked her to go to community college and get a skill. They wanted her to go to high schools and give lectures about the drinking and driving, which, of course, she could do very effectively. And, you know, they had a list of things that she needed to do. And she also heard the agony of what they had experienced because of her actions and apologized. Now, an apology certainly is not going to bring mm-hmm. Elaine back, the sister. But there was something very powerful that transpired. And what Elizabeth said is she didn't want to spend the rest of her life enraged at what had happened. She needed to find a different path towards peace. And that's what that family did.
Yeah.
And I think it's an inspiring story because they found a way. You think of something like that happening, you think it would destroy your life. And they found a way to go on.
Yeah. At the outset of her story, you quote her saying, there's an old Yiddish phrase, when you go out for revenge, you have to dig two graves.
And ain't that the truth?
Yeah.
It really is. Also,
she says something in the story that I think is very useful. When one is, one wants to make an apology. She also, she must be a very religious woman. She talks about Yom Kippur, the time when Jews are supposed to focus on forgiveness, and the word, the Hebrew word, teshuva, a Hebrew word that comes from the root to turn around. And in her synagogue, in a classroom, there was on the board the five R's of teshuva: recognition, remorse, repentance, restitution, and reform.
Yeah, she talks about each of those, and she said when she saw that, at that point she was still having a lot of revenge fantasies and thinking about how she could blind Susanna Cooper so she could never drive again. And she said when she saw that, she realized that she had to give her a chance to perform all of those actions, and that if she did, then she would be able to forgive her. And so I think going through the mediation process was a way to give Suzanne the chance to do the five R's, and she actually did complete them. I mean, she was able to fulfill all of those things, and it really helped create healing between her and the family.
Mm-hmm. Is the process of mediation one that many people use?
I don't really have any statistics on how many people do. I think it's there's a lot of great mediation happening, not just personally, but between like warring groups or warring nations, between groups that hate each other, between, you know, factions of the church, one of whom condemns homosexuality and one who wants to let, you know, gay priests in. That there are a lot of really skilled mediators who are going into situations where people are very polarized and giving them tools so they could dialogue with each other, not to try to debate each other or convince each other, but to try to find out these other people are human beings and what is the common ground that we share. And it's a very powerful technique, which I think could really make a transformational change in our world, the more those kind of dialogues take place. I know I've been talking recently to a couple in Northern California who started a Jewish-Palestinian living room dialogue group. And their group has been so successful. They've been meeting for 9 or 10 years, once a month, a group of Arabs and a group of Jews in living rooms. They've been eating meals and talking together and having these dialogues. And there now are 300 such groups all over the world because people feel this sense that it is so important that we come up with some tools for breaking through the conflicts that are, you know, really threatening our whole world. And, you know, so there are people who say that, and their slogan is something Margaret Mead said, is that a small group of committed citizens can change the world. Mm. You know, that's what they have on all their literature.
Mm.
And I think that's a wonderfully optimistic position to take.
Mm. We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for, for talking with us this afternoon, Laura.
You're welcome.
Laura Davis has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of I Thought We'd Never Speak Again, The Road from Estrangement to Reconciliation. You can also find her on the World Wide Web at www.lauradavis.net.